Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to a seasonal episode of Naylor's Natter, turkey sandwiched as we are in between Christmas and New Year. So we no TDT section or podcast pedagogy this week, as we're going to go back to basics for the festive period. Our normal service will be resumed in January. So this week I'm in conversation with Lisa Fathers, and Lisa Fathers is the Director of Teaching School Partnership at the Alliance for Learning as part of Bright Futures Educational Trust. And Lisa has taught English and drama for a number of years in several schools and was a middle leader, a senior leader, a deputy head teacher and then associate head teacher. So in this week's wide-ranging interview, we talk about my favourite subjects, namely professional learning and culture. And we also talk about the huge importance of mental health and Lisa's work in this area. We also natter about school-to-school support, the use of SLEs, and of course, Alliance for Learning's links with research schools and the use of evidence in their work. And excitingly, at the end of this interview, Lisa turns the tables on me as she is very soon to become one of my bosses, as I move into the next stage of my career. So listen out for that big reveal at the end of the podcast. So get the running trainers on, start the new year health kick as you mean to go on, and settle down for an interview with Lisa Fathers. Okay, so hello Lisa and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Yes, in the week before Christmas, so you know, you've put down the Christmas card, you've stopped the wrapping, you're ready to speak for a little bit on Naylor's Natter. Thank you for that.
Absolutely, feeling very festive here in Manchester.
Well, super. Well, we might have to put a little bit of Christmas music on later, but before we do that, let's get into the questions. So, it's a nice, gentle introductory question, so just tell us a little bit about your career journey to date.
Okay, will do. Okay, so many moons ago, I did my PGC at Manchester University, English with Drama. Big shout out to John Keane, the best course leader ever. And I love Manchester. I think it's a great city. And it was a real privilege to be asked back, actually, quite recently to Manchester University to share my leadership journey with trainees. And in terms of our skit, we use Manchester University for the PGC elements of our course as well. So there's some nice links there back to my past. Then I did my first 10 years at a huge mixed comprehensive in Warrington, teaching mainly English, but also drama GCSE. And in that 10 years, I had so many different responsibilities that I felt like I had a really good grounding in terms of middle leadership and beyond. So I had some English departmental responsibilities, people voice, adult learning, led on literacy for a spell. In terms of pastoral, I was behaviour manager, senior tutor. I think one of my favourite roles at that school was primary liaison and community outreach, because I got to work really closely with the head and the head teacher of the local primary schools quite early on in my career, which was great CPD, you know, being exposed to kind of really strategic conversations that early on. I also was head of PFHE and citizenship. I even had a short spell being seconded to Warrington's healthy schools team back in the day when they existed, doing some research around teenage pregnancy. And I was always really outward facing, and I did my first 10 years there, and then I was really ready to move to SLT. So I started to look round and went on mat leave, and like you do, applied for my first senior leadership job whilst on mat leave, and got it. And this was a girls' school in Trafford at a sports college, and I was director of specialism back in the day when specialist sports colleges existed. Now, you might be thinking, Phil, how does an English teacher lead the specialism of sports? But I felt I did a really good job because I wasn't PE, and I was able to be more strategic about the whole school approach, the ethos of sports, you know, how we use teamwork and leadership and coaching across the school. And back in the day, sports colleges were the fastest improving schools out of all the specialisms, and I really loved that job. And, you know, I got to work with the Youth Sport Trust and Baroness Sue Campbell. And we were also the hub site for a school sport partnership, so I oversaw all of that outreach work from a really strategic point of view. And then at that same school, I became deputy head there after 4 years, when I led on teaching and learning, CPD appraisal, then moved to behaviour and safeguarding for a while. And in my last year there, I was ready for headship and started looking for headship roles. My title was changed to associate head teacher because of the level I was working at and quite a lot of outreach work I was doing. I'd done my MPQH. And then I saw the job advertised at Alter Girls, which was head of teaching school and co-principal across the trust. So long story short, really excited because it's rooted in skill improvement, an opportunity to use my business and entrepreneurial skills too and build something really exciting. And I absolutely love it. A couple of years ago, we got a new CEO, John Stevens, who's amazing. And I moved on to the executive team then, and my title changed ever so slightly to Director of Teaching, School and Partnerships to really reflect the work I do as a trust exec as well. And I'm really passionate about the work I do. I feel so privileged to be working with so many schools in a really strategic role, having quite a wide impact. And I do things like coaching head teachers, representing our trust on the Greater Manchester Reform Board, obviously all the work I do around health and wellbeing. I'm a national trainer with Mental Health First Aid England and currently doing MPQEL, which is the Executive Leader Qualification. So in a nutshell, I couldn't be happier. I'm really challenged. I feel like every day is different and my work is really rewarding. I think that brings me up to date to where I am now, Phil.
Well, I'm just taking a breath, Lisa, because, I mean, there's so much stuff there that we can ask about, and also just how passionate you are about it, particularly as this is being recorded in the last week of what, for some listeners, will be a nine-week half-term. So that's just given me a bit of a shot in the arm and a bit of enthusiasm to carry us through for the rest of this. So that's absolutely fantastic. Can I just drill down a little bit into some of that? So you talked about your career journey there. Just tell us about how important it was to create professional learning cultures when you were deputy head teacher.
Okay, so looking back, really important and was at the core of everything that I did and that SLP did. And I think I just want to define what that term means, if that's all right. Mm-hmm. So for me, professional learning culture is one in which we as educators are committed to our own growth and development as professionals. And I think that this kind of culture kind of grows out of a deep professional desire to continue to ensure ongoing development of staff knowledge and practice and to really create opportunities for lifelong learning. And at the time, the school that I was at really needed to improve, and myself and the head worked really hard to create a vision based on principles of the founding principles of aspiration, empowerment, and excellence. And those three things kind of underpin everything that we did in terms of a professional learning culture and driving the school forward at pace. And I guess the way that we approached that was quite multi-layered. So we ensured that appraisal was effective, that things that, you know, you'd expect, like the school development plan, the SEF, appraisal and CPD were all joined up. And it's easy to say, but it's not easy to do sometimes to make sure that all those systems are working together. I wanted to introduce staff to the notion of taking responsibility for their own continued learning. So I introduced really simple things like a CPD library in the staff room. And that wasn't about creating a reading list, but it was about getting staff to be really thirsty for knowledge about their subjects, about leadership, about the craft of teaching, and then having a blog about it in a way that became every day. So conversations about teaching happening, you know, on the corridor, in the staff room. Trying to think back now, I think other things that I did was, you know, revamped the CPD offer in school in terms of the programme of Twilight. One of the areas back then, it's a long time ago, was a focus around student engagement. And we used the work of Spencer Kagan's work on cooperative learning. And you know, back then, giving the staff a kind of toolbox of strategies to use, it was quite important, and that worked really well. I think the other thing that I did was kind of each other in different schools as well. And I think that effective teaching is informed by personal knowledge, trial, error, reflection on practice, conversations with colleagues. And I think that that observing regularly creates a critical dimension to teaching. You know, if staff went out on training, we ensured that dissemination happened. And we also tried to embed a bit of a coaching culture, kind of linked to the specialism of sport. And allowing staff to be the best version of themselves. And what the school did was introduce something called Pacific Institute Training, which was really about getting people to be effective as people, as humans first, and then how that then kind of related to you as a worker in your environment. In terms of students, that professional learning culture was about high expectations, harnessing student voice. We set up things like the Student Learning Innovation Group so that students could share, you know, what worked best for them as learners and that teachers could hear that. And I think that that's really powerful to hear from the students about that. And finally, but by no means least, we took in trainees because, You know, I believe, as you'd expect, coming from a teaching school in a skit, that hosting trainees keeps us fresh. It forces us to break our subject down, the craft of teaching, and it keeps us at the forefront of innovation. You know, and as deputy head back then, I was really proud when the school was graded good. And under Ofsted, the leadership management was graded as outstanding, with some specific comments really about how the sports specialism was used to inspire students and how well teaching and learning was led. So yeah, it was a great time. It's always a real privilege to be part of a school when it's on a journey, isn't it?
Absolutely, and possibly more of that later on. But before we go into that, just bring us a bit more up to date in terms of things that you've been involved in the last few years.
Yeah.
So just tell listeners a little bit about how you've been involved with the Mentally Healthy Schools pilot.
Okay. So yes, the Mentally Healthy Schools pilot is no longer a pilot, but you are right, it was at the start. So it's now the Mentally Healthy Schools and Colleges programme in Greater Manchester. So just to give you a little bit of context, you know, I'm part of a national training team in Mental Health First Aid England, and in Greater Manchester, I represent schools on the executive team for health and wellbeing. And I also co-chair the Greater Manchester Mental Health and Education Board. So what I try and do is link this with the work of the Greater Manchester Head Teacher Alliance for Peace, Sport and Health, because essentially what I'd really like is that we could just have one conversation about health rather than talking about physical health over there and mental health over here. And that's really the premise of the Mentally Healthy Schools and Colleges programme. It's part of a major £134 million action plan announced in 2017 to help transform mental health in Greater Manchester. And it was commissioned by the Greater Manchester Health and Social Care Partnership. And really, what we try to do is take a proactive approach. So rather than, you know, thinking about all the stuff that's out there around supporting children when they become troubled, what we wanted to do was really do some front-end work to try and help schools prevent and really be very well informed. So in March 2018, phase one of the Mentally Healthy Schools pilot and was rolled out involving 31 primary and secondary schools, special schools and Pru was in there as well. And this was about doing something really rapid and quick and testing out what worked. So the first phase, we used schools within my teaching school alliance, because it was a little bit like a test and learn project. And what we did was we worked with a group of partners around the table and created a bit of a package. So my teaching school coordinated it all, and my team provided mental health first aid to four people in each school. The Youth Sport Trust, a national charity, provided the most amazing athletes that went into school, and they work with groups of children who are the young mental health ambassadors, and they work with them on really bringing physical activity in line with mental health, and really work with them on how them, as young people, can actually be ambassadors for mental health and try and reduce taboo and things like that. Place to Be, a children's mental health charity, I'm sure you've heard of them. They deliver training to senior leaders. And 42nd Street provide one-to-one support to really vulnerable children in the schools. And so if you can imagine each school's getting all this, it's very multi-layered. And I think that really is the beauty of it. And us as a group of partners have really worked together to make sure that this works and that the school receives the support in the right way, and that it's really managed well, and bringing that physical and mental health together so that the two things are equally important but intertwined, I think is really crucial. So yeah, it's been fantastic. I know reading your mind, so you're probably going to ask me about the impact so far. So what I can tell you from our interim evaluation is that school leaders have reported increased confidence and knowledge. Year 10 and year 5 students report the same in terms of confidence and feeling better to talk and able to cope with stress and empowered to champion mental health. Now, an organisation called Cork are doing a really in-depth evaluation at the moment, so we can revisit these stats perhaps later in the year. But I think for me, the power of story is really important. And if it's all right, I just want to tell you just two very short stories that I think bring this project and programme to life. So story one, it's Stanley Grove Primary School in Gorton. They have every single child running the daily mile every day, and over 100 parents joining in most mornings. So you've got parental engagement, culture, improved conversations. And as a result of the mental health first aid aspects of this program, they've actually changed their physical first aid stations in school to be physical and mental health stations. And one little girl said to me, I now know where to go if I've got a cut on my finger or if I'm really worried about something. And I just absolutely love the simplicity of that. And during a recent Ofsted in summer term, a little girl said to the lead inspector that she couldn't wait to go back to Pakistan and show girls that they could play football too and they could be anything they want to be. And you know, that's the impact of the programme. And there are lots of other stories like that I could tell you, but I'm conscious of time here, so we can come back to it if you want.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, you did read my mind there, so, you know, extra marks for that. I was going to move on to talk a little bit about, you mentioned all the different partners that were working together on that, yeah. And you also mentioned that earlier in your first answer about all the different jobs you've had. So I guess the question I'm coming around to is, how important was collaboration to this programme and to your career so far, I suppose?
Okay. Well, I think it's incredibly important. It's at the core of everything that teaching schools do. And in terms of this particular programme, that collaboration between the partner organisations has been really crucial. And for me, actually, it's been one of the best things about the programme because there's been so much shared learning, you know, health working with education, third sector organisations. And I think partnership work sounds really easy, but actually it's dead hard. It's dead hard to get right. It's all about relationships, and relationships take a little bit of time, don't they? And then relationships need nurturing. And I think we've established trusting relationships now between ourselves and with the health social care partnership that we obviously have to report into. And I think we often use the term whole system working, but genuinely, that is really what we're trying to do in Greater Manchester. So cross sector, whole system working, you know, less working in silos. And, you know, I might be biased, but I think one of the best things about this project is that health have had the sense to use a teaching school network to make this happen. So something that schools are already familiar with, so that they see it as a school-to-school support model, that the majority of schools know what that looks like, know what that feels like. And just a basic point, if it had just been health rolling this out, then they might not have taken in the fact that, you know, Easter holidays can span 4 weeks and just some of the really operational things around, you know, working with the school rhythms. So collaboration has been really important. And now, obviously, as director of teaching school, you know, collaboration underpins the whole work of our alliance, the partnerships we have with licensed providers for all the programmes that we run, partnerships with all the schools. You know, to me, collaboration is absolutely everything. And I think it's about giving. And I think if you give generously, then it comes back to you, you know, three times over.
Mm. No, absolutely. I was just thinking about, in terms of collaboration, if I might go off on a slight anecdote from the work that we've been doing, Research School and Teacher Development Trust. So I'm going to come to ask you in a minute about how school-to-school support work fits into your teaching school. But just before I do that, you know, we found it to be so, so powerful. And, you know, if I can give a shout out on air to the File Course Teaching School Alliance, which has been a real massive partner in helping us with the research school to be able to get into schools. Because when we started both those projects, we had the research school, we had a lot of content that we would like to get into school and we'd like to put in teachers' hands and give the opportunity to use it. But also through the Teacher Development Trust Hub, we had, you know, contacts with teachers to get into classrooms. But what the File Course Teacher School Alliance and others, and obviously, you know, St Mary's and the schools that I've been working in, but it's that collaboration to get across and to get all of those different people working together for the same goal has been so, so powerful. And any of the success that we have had wouldn't have been the case without that kind of school-to-school support. So how does that school-to-school support work fit into your teaching school work?
Okay. Well, obviously, school-to-school support work is central to the work that we do as a teaching school. It's incredibly important to us, both within our MAT and beyond. And I think really for us, it's about two things. There's the school-to-school support that's a bit more informal, so things like our good practice sharing, subject networks, various hubs like our PFHG hub, our EAL hub, leadership breakfast and things like that. And then there's more formal work, so, you know, commission stuff like, you know, doing a school review, a safeguarding review, a subject review. But, you know, perhaps an example would be the work that I've done in Blackpool, leading an improvement strategy around English across the high schools. And we sometimes get work where we develop a strategy across somebody else's map. And then there's some specific work to help schools improve as well. So, for example, there's a couple of schools at the moment where I'm doing some work to help shape their middle leadership teams, and lots of bespoke CPD as well. So I think skill support, it's flexible. It needs to take the shape that it needs to take. And actually, I think one of the core messages here as well is that teaching schools need to work together. So, you know, you mentioned Far Coast, and Tim's been great in terms of the Blackpool School Improvement Board as well. And, you know, bringing people together and making sure that people are up to date. And equally in Greater Manchester, we've got, a group of teaching schools that work together to share resources. You know, we borrow SLEs off each other and things like that when we might run out of a particular subject. And I think that hub working is really crucial on lots of levels.
Mm. Now, again, you're reading my mind with these questions, Lisa, so I was going to ask about SLEs. I was fortunate enough to be appointed as an SLE. Now, with one reason or another, because of various different things that we've been doing, you know, been extremely busy, so I've never really been deployed as a science SLE, but I know that's something that you do really, really well. And I saw something on Twitter when you were just training your latest cohort of SLEs. And I've said to Simon Cox, we looked at the picture, we just couldn't believe the number of people with the beaming smiles that were in that room. It looked fantastic. So tell us a little bit about how you work with SLEs, how you deploy them, how you recruit them, just all that kind of thing.
Okay. So we have 140 SLE now being a large teaching school at the Alliance for Learning. And, you know, first of all, I'm an SLE and I think it's an absolute privilege. It's the best CPD that you can ever have. And for me, it's all about system leadership. So it's groups of talented leaders working together beyond their own usual boundaries to have an impact on children across whole areas and not just their own school, and utilising that collective power. And what I say to SLEs on the training is that, you know, it's no longer about thinking about the outcomes for the children in your class or your school. It's about outcomes for all children and all young people. And it's really rewarding. And for me, you know, when I deploy a group of SLEs to a school and the school really manages that support well, and then we go on a journey with that school, the best thing for me is when a school goes from being quite a capacity taker to being a capacity giver. And there's so many schools that we've worked with over the last 4 years at Alliance for Learning that have gone from being schools that have needed a lot of support, and now they've been on a journey and they're the ones now giving the support, and the support is so good because they absolutely know, you know, what incremental work needs to happen to get them to move from A to B to C. So I was just conscious that we keep saying SLEs and it's like acronym bingo sometimes. So, you know, SLE stands for Specialist Leader of Education, for anybody that's out there that doesn't know what it is. And really, these are people that are outstanding middle or senior leaders with a particular expertise or talent in a subject area or a phase or a proven track record of success, you know, with a particular theme in school. And most SLEs have got, you know, a number of kind of specialisms, if you like. So if you take yourself, Phil, I'm guessing you could probably do leadership as well as science and maybe pastoral and a few things like that. So you've asked about deploying SLEs. So first of all, in terms of selecting SLEs and deploying them, the answer to that is that it's done really carefully. We have an open recruitment process, but then a really robust application process where I will shortlist with the team. Each application has to be endorsed by the SLE's own head teacher. And then we have a full interview day that includes a variety of tasks, written tasks, group tasks, presentations. And then, of course, we have a full training day. And then that isn't the end of it, because then we provide ongoing coaching for our SLEs. We give them example, documents to look at. Obviously, because we've got so many SLEs, sometimes I might use a more experienced senior kind of SLE to perhaps coach or oversee, you know, 10 SLEs that are in a school, because there's only one of me. And some SLEs might need a bit more coaching than others. And equally, we bring them back. So you mentioned the training last week. So that photo was all the new SLEs. And in the afternoon, we had all our existing SLEs come back for a session with Ofsted to look at the new framework and curriculum. And then in terms of actual deployment, again, I take really a great care, really, how I deploy SLEs. And at first, you know, I might have some SLEs shadowing others or accompanying them on deployments or being part of a review. And for me, it's about knowing the schools that I'm supporting really well so that I can match people well. Now, you know, that's how it works in practice, in an ideal world. There are some times when perhaps all my English SLEs might be out and it might be the one that's not out on deployment that I end up saying to the school, look, this is the person that's left. But because they're all really good and because we take such care with recruitment, there really isn't anybody that I would feel uncomfortable sending out on deployment because, you know, they're all really good. And obviously one of the things that we do on the training is we make it very clear that, you know, if there's a question they're unsure of or they think that the issue that they're going in to solve is bigger than them, then they bring it back to me, really, and I will help them. And just to give an example, one of the things that we've been doing in Blackpool with the English improvement work was deploying SLEs. And I had one of our wonderful SLEs from Altrincham Grammar School for Girls, Helen, who went to support a PRU in Blackpool. And, you know, you might have some sceptics saying, you know, how could somebody from a grammar support, you know, so, you know, English in a PRU? And actually, that was the best feedback that we got. The PRU said that she made a massive impact on the quality of English, the curriculum, you know, lesson planning, everything that they did. And I think that just demonstrates to me that actually it's about the quality of their SLE, their ability to be able to understand the context that they're going into, and their ability to draw on other experiences and make it work. And, you know, good subject knowledge is good subject knowledge. Good teaching is good teaching. And it's about relationships. So has that answered your questions?
Perfectly. Yeah, I was writing a few notes while you were doing it as well. I was just thinking there's some future things for us, because we did something similar in terms of the research school around appointing ELEs. And I know that Simon did a training day, probably very similar to the one that you did. So it's good to learn from kind of your expertise about the best way to deploy people and, you know, the best way to kind of manage the group of people you've got there to grow your capacity, because, you know, the research school particularly, although people think it's a sort of a glass-fronted building with massive six-foot letters on the top, although actually it is going to be pretty soon, but at the moment it isn't, it's just a cupboard, so it's neat about growing that capacity, and this is a really good way to do it. Sorry, Lisa, I've talking all you want.
It's all right. I was just going to say, I'm really happy to talk to you and Simon about that, you know, if it helps us all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure that this is leading in nice to the next question. So obviously we're working with a range of different schools and a range of different teaching schools. So I think that as we go into 2020, there's going to be a little bit more of a closer working relationship between your teaching school and Blackpool Research School. So just tell us a little bit about what experience you've had of research work so far and what kind of things you hope to gain from that sort of growing relationship there.
Okay. So I'll take your first bit of the question first. So, you know, first of all, I think that research and having an evidence-informed approach to all aspects of school life, not least teaching and learning, is essential. You know, if you look back to the Berra Report in 2014, it talks about, you know, three interconnected and complementary aspects of teachers' professional knowledge: wisdom, practical wisdom, technical knowledge, and critical reflection. And in the past, I think it's fair to say that as teachers, we might have gone with gut instincts about what works. And, you know, I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that, because I think, you know, good teachers do have good instincts, and sometimes that instinct can come from a real place of experience. But I think that research can enhance everything, and it adds real depth and richness to all things. And so perhaps, you know, enhancing a teacher's technical knowledge about a particular instructional technique and things like that. And I do think it's fair to say, though, that anybody doing research in education ought to spend time in schools, in my opinion, just to keep things real and to appreciate the realities of day-to-day school life. So in terms of my experiences with research, you know, I'm not deep into research like yourself, Phil, but I've always tried to be informed. So as a middle leader a long time ago in Warrington, I was responsible for adult learning at the school, and I was involved in some fascinating local research about parenting. And now as a parent myself, I think it's quite fascinating and scary, the impact that we have on our children. And you know, I recently read that parenting is becoming more important in determining life chances than anything else, with social mobility stagnating. And I guess that we all know that the softer skills required for real success, you know, broadened and softened a bit. And if we think about, you know, self-regulation and empathy. So I think that parents do play a huge role in that, and that research about that is really important, I think, for us as teachers in terms of the messages we give to our parents. Moving on, so just thinking about research in terms of my deputy role for teaching and learning, I think back then we used the Japanese lesson study model, and we certainly used it across our maths hub and in our teaching school. And I think that when we look back at various projects across the teaching school, actually, we can backtrack a lot of things back to that lesson study model. So it's quite interesting to think about. And another example would be when I did a short spell in this school where I was supporting the local authority because the head teacher in this particular school was off. And one of my focuses there was to support the leadership team in improving appraisal processes, but also really embed an element of research into appraisal targets so that research could be more embedded in the school and really make teachers more curious about learning and teaching and how they knew that things that we're doing had impact. And of course, thinking back to my role as pastoral deputy and safeguarding lead, you know, research and information pertinent to that role was really important too. So, you know, thinking about, you know, the Monroe Review in 2011 and the Children Commissioner's Report on CSE in 2012. And I can remember digesting those things and thinking, you know, how does that research impact on my day-to-day role and what we need to be doing in school? And now just, you know, thinking back to where I am now and the role in our SCIT, you know, everything that we do within the SCIT and teacher training, research underpins all of that. And Cal, who was our SCIT lead before he went off to be head at Cedar Mount, drew on a wealth of research really to help us ensure that our ITP program was well planned and effective. And I can remember Cal doing some work with the Sutton Trust Review, what makes great teaching, and unpicking that with trainees actually. And finally, the other thing that I just wanted to mention, one of our programs, kind of one of our niche routes into teaching actually, is called Researchers in Schools. And this is exclusively for PhD graduates, and it's specifically designed to utilise their academic expertise to benefit pupils in schools and really try and work with pupils and make them think about going to university. And it runs over 3 years. It's subsidised by the DfE, and it's a really exciting way of thinking about recruitment in subjects that are hard to recruit for as well, like science and maths. So that's something that, you know, I'm really keen that more schools know about because it's really quite interesting how that all works. But I'm sure that's a whole other podcast, so we'll move on now.
Well, we can always put you in for another podcast. I mean, you know, there's so much good stuff to get in. It's definitely we could do take two in 2020. Definitely, I'll hold you to that.
Okay. Right.
Just on the research thing, I mean, it's interesting how you started it. And I'm really inclined to agree with what you said about, you know, personal experience. And this is part of the journey we've had in terms of the research school. So we very much started with the Sir Kevin Collins line. And I know why he used it. You know, he used, if you're not using evidence, then you must be using prejudice. And it was a kind of to get a bit of traction and the movement and get people thinking about their own practice in terms of an evidence base. But I like the way that it's softened now to become, you know, that evidence should supplement, not supplant, professional expertise. Yeah. And I've mentioned that before, and I think there is a role for, you know, your own experience in your own context, in your own classroom, as long as it does have some kind of basis in evidence or research as well. So it's interesting that you're seeing that kind of reflected within the teaching school as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think a whole other podcast could be all the research around mental health and the studies done on attachment and poverty and, you know, all the links around all of that. And you know, that's really important evidence and research as well, because that affects how we work with our children and young people, and also how we design programs to work with teachers to support them as well. So, you know, I'm completely in agreement with you.
Brilliant. Right, so we're into our last question on this section, although we are going to move on slightly, as listeners will find out shortly. So finally in this section, and you started the podcast, and you've maintained this all the way through, but you started it absolutely enthusiastically about how great everything has been in your career so far. So why is it that you're so passionate about PE when actually you're an English teacher?
That's a very good question. So I'm very passionate about sports and physical activity and PE, and I think that those three things are different, and it's important that we recognise that. So there's sport, there's physical activity, which is just moving, and then there's PE. And I've already mentioned that my first SLT role was in a sports college, and that's when I got to know the Youth Sport Trust. And the Youth Sport Trust are an amazing national charity with a very simple mission, which is to build a brighter future for young people through sport. And what that means is that they use sport as a vehicle to help unlock young people's potential. And for me, they were a real eye-opener in terms of how we can use that broader physical activity piece in schools to not just drive outcomes and attainment, but also to improve culture. And actually, you know, we're sending these children out to live in the world, and we want them to be able to stay healthy and well. And in terms of physical activity and sport, you know, my own experiences of PE and sport at school were shocking. You know, I was one of those unfit teenagers, always the last person to be picked for a team, You know, my daughter doesn't believe me when I tell her. But I didn't want that to be the case for any of the schools that I've taught in or that I work with now. And, you know, I only ended up getting really passionate about exercise when I was doing my A-levels, and I ended up getting a job in a gym. And then I went on to become a fitness instructor. And as you know, I teach a spin class twice a week. And that's nothing to do with my love of 80s and 90s dance music. It is purely about the exercise.
Now, that is another podcast, Lisa. That is one we need to do that. If you, I don't know if you heard, and I'm sure you didn't hear my top 10 countdown of the most listened to podcasts. But yeah, 80s and 90s yeah. cheese music would be a perfect podcast. Anyway, sorry, Karen.
Oh, absolutely. We'll do that. So I think, you know, I have now got my own love of physical activity, and I absolutely know that for me, that keeping fit keeps me well and it keeps me sane. And I think one of the things that's been really nice this year has been the development of the PE and sports hubs that teaching schools are leading. So we're leading one at the moment, and that's all about working with schools to modernise PE and help to make sure that PE is relevant. And from a mental health and wellbeing point of view, we know that moving more makes us feel better. And you know that Sport England's Active Lives survey showed that across the UK, our children are just not as active as they should be. And as head teacher ambassador for the Youth Sport Trust, I feel it's my moral duty to champion the power of PE, physical activity and physical literacy. And now we're really lucky in Greater Manchester. We've got a brilliant school games provision, and this is being broadened to be more inclusive and involve more children in competitive sport. And I do believe that, you know, competitive sport is important, you know, getting children to have a go, win, lose, and feel that teamwork. And sitting behind all of that in Manchester, we've got a Greater Sport team who are brilliant, and they, you know, work on the Greater Manchester Moving Strategy, which aims to get more people moving more. And it is that simple. And I think if I said to you, Phil, that I've developed a new magic potion that makes you sleep better, improves mental health, helps you maintain a stable weight, helps older people with dementia, improves your mood, and I've also got some really good evidence and research, Phil, that those children that are more active leave school with better outcomes, you'd be asking me, you know, what is this magic potion and what do I have to do to get it and how much does it cost? Well, that magic potion is about making sure that schools prioritise physical activity, PE and sport. So my message here, and I am getting on my soapbox a bit, is don't reduce PE time. Keep it on the timetable at a minimum 2 hours a week. Don't take Year 11 students out of PE in the run-up to Year 11 exams to do extra English and math, because they need to move more then than any other time in their lives to help them de-stress and cope. You know, do make sure that extracurricular provision is varied and active. You know, make sure that you've got girls football, you know, in the curriculum and as enrichment. You know, I'm sure that you've all seen the Lionesses and, you know, the century that we're in, we don't need to be having to take girls to do football in other places. It should be there in school. And do prioritise sport in primary schools as well, and make sure that sport premium money is spent really well and not on a man in a van coming. You know, make sure it's spent on things that will have impact. Because in addition to all those things that PE and sport can do for individual students, what it can also do is help build a really positive culture and ethos. And I think this is incredibly important. And at Bright Futures and at our schools, you know, PE and physical activity is at the heart of all we do. So I hope I've not got on my soapbox too much there, but it is something I'm really passionate about. And I think it's something that everybody should be passionate about, because it's how we stay well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I did a podcast probably at the beginning of last year with Liam Webb, who does some online stuff around Pete, and he was very much echoing all the things that you've talked about there. So, you know, if you want to go further into that, yeah, have a little look at his podcast as well.
Maybe I'll go for a run with him.
You'll beat him, don't worry about it. You'll be miles ahead of him. I hope he's listening to this now, because we do so I'm going off a tangent slightly, but Liam and I, because Liam's moved schools now, so Liam is at a different school, but I'm still in touch with him through the wonderful world of Twitter. So we do the Red January. So we did that last year.
Oh, yeah.
And we've done the Movembers and all these kind of things with lots of creative challenges. But he is much younger and much fitter than me, which is not difficult, to be honest. so, yeah, he tends to win these things. But I do sort of drag along. And I think that my veteran category now affords me a little bit of a start, doesn't it? So, you know, I'm a bit close when we had that. Oh, yeah, it does. Okay, so before we do something a little bit different at the end, Lisa, and I believe at the end you're going to turn the tables on me because we did promise listeners that there would be a big reveal, and I've kind of sat on this exciting news, and my word, it's been hard to sit on this for about 7 weeks now and not say a word about this. So I'm like, I'm itching to say, to tell people what this is. But before we do, can you just signpost listeners a little bit to some of the websites you've mentioned? So your teaching school, you personally on Twitter, and anything that you're on up to in the next few months.
No problem. So my Twitter handle is at Lisa Fathers, AFL. I'm based at Altrincham Grammar School for Girls, and my multi-academy trust is Bright Futures Educational Trust. And the teaching school is the Alliance for Learning, and our website is allianceforlearning.co.uk. And we have launching in January a brand new PSHE hub, and I think that that is an area that's becoming really important for our schools with all the changes, so do look out for information on that. Okay.
Absolutely, will do. Right, so if you're going to turn the tables on me, I feel like I should pass you the mic, but you've got your own there, haven't you? So,
I have.
Over to Nailers Natters with Lisa Fathers instead of me.
Okay, Phil, it's really nice of you to join me this evening, so thank you. How are you?
Yes, I'm very good, thank you. Yeah, a bit nervous being on the other side of this. It feels a bit strange.
Jolly good, good, good. Okay, so first of all, I just want you to talk to me about the job that you're doing at the moment and, you know, how you feel about the fact that you are leaving.
Well, the current jobs, I've got many jobs. I always say this when I start off doing presentations. So I am, in no particular order, I am assistant head teacher at St Mary's in Blackpool. I have been since 2013. I still teach a lot of science. I always say that. I'm still very much a classroom teacher. I'm also the Teacher Development Trust expert advisor, which sounds really lofty, doesn't it? But it's not as lofty as that, but it's still important. And I am the assistant director of the Blackpool Research School, which is a title that we made up, Lisa. So me and Simon Cox actually went to Huntingdon Research School when Alex Quigley was running it. And we saw he had director on his door. So we thought, well, we'll have a bit of that. And we made up these titles. So we've been calling ourselves these directors. But it's kind of a self-titled job. So those are my three current jobs at the moment.
Okay. And I believe that you have some exciting news and that you're leaving your current job. So how do you feel about that?
Well, I feel very, very excited about this, and it's been 7 weeks since I've been able to say anything about this. So, to all the listeners out there, I am extremely fortunate that I'll be working much more closely with Lisa from now on. So I managed to secure Deputy Head of School at the wonderful South Shore Academy in Blackpool, which is a school that, as part of the Teacher Development Trust, I've been in for the last 2 or 3 years. They've got a fantastic team, a leadership team there, and the teachers are just brilliant. And obviously the pupils that I've met, and I have met quite a few of the pupils over the time that I've been there, are superb as well. So I am so grateful for the opportunity, so excited to get started, and it's going to be straight after Christmas. So I've been in 3 or 4 times. The staff have been brilliant, like I said, making me feel really welcome. So I'm looking forward to getting into that, and hopefully, like I said before, working pretty closely with Bright Futures, Alliance for Learning, and, you know, the teaching school as well.
Woo! So congratulations, and we're absolutely delighted that you're joining our trust and joining South Shore. And I, like you, have been dying to shout this from the rooftops as well, because just as you're really delighted, we're absolutely thrilled that, you know, somebody of your calibre is coming to join our trust and work at South Shore. And I know that the team there are really excited about January as well. So a huge congratulations from us, and enjoy your last few days.
Yeah, it's getting very close now. So I've got, I'm still doing the Teacher Development Trust moving forward until the end of that in March. So David has been fantastic, because I know that David, and you mentioned John Stevens before, have been absolutely fantastic, accommodating, trying to get everything done. And thanks to all the schools that have allowed me to do that. So yeah, still got some involvement there.
Right.
And Simon Cox, if he's listening, which it strangely he does, for a man that spends his life listening to me go on in an office. I don't know why he listens to this as well, but he does. He's also, we're going to be continuing some of the work. So you mentioned before about, you know, your teaching school working closely with the research school. So I'm going to keep that ELE status, and hopefully we can continue to do stuff like, for example, Lisa, the South Shore Teach Meet, which is coming up pretty quickly after Christmas as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So shout out to the South Shore Teach Meet. I'm sure you'll see details on Twitter, but I think we have about 30 tickets left now. So finally, Phil, I think the question that everybody's going to be thinking about when they listen to this is, will Phil still be doing Nailers Natters even when he's in his new role at South Shore? So do you want to just put everybody's minds at rest?
Well, it's quite interesting because, as everybody knows, I'm a massive fan of the implementation guide. So I've even done an implementation guide for continuing the podcast moving forward, which might sound quite geeky, but for those of you that know me, that's pretty much me anyway. So we are going to continue.
Sounds very geeky.
It does sound very geeky, yeah, it does. We are going to continue, but it's going to be a little bit like, do you remember when Have I Got News For You kind of diversified its presenters? Years and years ago, I started to have a different presenter every week and keep moving things around. So we're going to do something.
I don't remember that, but you are older than me, so you know.
You had to get that one in. You had to get that one in. Yes, that is true. That is true. So the idea is going to be that there's going to be some other people who will present some of the podcasts as well, because to do it every week has been brilliant. It's been the best kind of CPD that I've had, but it is quite time consuming, and I want to make sure that I'm giving South Shore as much of my time as I possibly can to make sure that, you know, I'm up to speed quickly, because, you know, starting a job in January, it's not something I've done before, so hopefully I can do that. But yeah, I've got the wonderful Catherine Morgan, if she's listening, is helping me out presenting a few podcasts. I know that David Weston and the team at the TDT are going to keep doing that as well, so we should be able to keep the conversations going. And I've got podcasts booked right up until March, so can I give you another exclusive as well, Lisa, while we're on?
Oh, yeah, please do.
So there's, I can't quite believe this one. So as everybody knows, Craig Barton has been kind of our guru of podcasting. He started all of this, and anything that we do is just copying off basically what he did. So he's agreed to come on. He's booked in for next year to talk about his new book as well. So I've got some really exciting guests in the new year. So, yep, very much going to keep it going. But like I said, spreading it out a little bit further to allow me to hopefully get up to speed and get settled into the new position.
Fantastic. Well, that's absolutely brilliant. That sounds like great legacy work there. So fantastic. So all that's left for me really is to say congratulations and Merry Christmas. And I hope that everybody listening has a lovely Christmas and a really nice break as well. I think we all deserve one. Thanks, Phil.
Absolutely. Thank you, Lisa. And thanks for being a guest. Really appreciate it. And I'm a bit scared now that you might pinch my job.
I don't think I've got time either, don't worry.
No, thank you. Bye.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, so as stated, no podcast pedagogy, but we're going to have some shameless plugs in the weekly shameless plugs section. So as we fly headlong into 2020, time for some plugs that are pretty quickly approaching now. So in a matter of a few weeks, we have our first team South Shore Academy gig with our Teach Meet. And a big well done to Emma and Nikki for pulling together all the speakers. They're coming from far and wide, and of course from within Blackpool. And also a shout out to the Chartered College for their support with this as well. Research at Birmingham will be here before we know it, and Claire Stoneman has done some sterling work putting together a stellar list of speakers with lots of debutants as well that are new to Research Ed, so I can't wait to be involved with that. Research at Blackpool is of course coming very soon, and it does feel strange to be talking about this now as I'm not as directly involved as Simon and the team, but they will pull together a fantastic day and I will be along to speak at the conference, so feel free to come and introduce yourself or just come and listen to me speak if that's what you'd like. And follow it all on Twitter or add yourself to the waiting list, because as you know, it very much is sold out. And speaking of Simon Cox, so we've got the small matter of our new book, which is officially out there. So I've been sitting on this for quite some months with limited progress. But as we are now separating slightly, it's time to get started with this. So we currently have the working title of Two Men in a Cupboard to reflect our 3 years as a research school. And in the book, we intend to offer our insights for what they're worth of almost 3 years as a research school and a teacher development trust. And we intend to look at how evidence-based practice can help teachers in all stages of your career and in all phases of education. And finally, for now, To continue to bring you this weekly Nailers Natter podcast, I'm going to be sharing out presenter duties, as I mentioned in the podcast with Lisa. So the marvellous Catherine Morgan, who is a very popular previous guest, will be assisting with the presenting duties. So it's going to be, in the next few weeks, more Morgan's musings than Nailers Natter, but as we now have an online presence, so to speak, best stick to the name. Plus, those jingles cost me an absolute fortune, so better stick with those. Just remains to say Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and thank you as ever for listening to Nailers Natter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.